Greetings, welcome to The Dividing Line. Good to be back here in Phoenix, Arizona, if only briefly, and it is brief. I have lined out an insane schedule for myself, and excited to mention that I got an email this morning, and it looks like we're gonna pray toward this end, and might as well put a plug in for some support here too. The trip to South Africa that we want to do is going to be a couple weeks later in the year than normal, mainly because in September I'm going to be teaching first in Zurich and then Kiev. So that pretty much takes care of September. So probably about a week later, so starting in October. And, of course, we still need to raise funds for that. And really excited, hopefully going to be doing a series of lectures on Bart Ehrman's book, How Jesus Became God, responding to that. I think that's going to be very important. But now, as of this morning, we are working on arranging a debate on homosexuality with one of the leading advocates of the gay Christian movement in South Africa. For the trip in South Africa. So, still got to get there. So, if you'd like to see that debate take place, then there is a, store.aomin.org/travel.html. I'm memorizing it. So, I'm excited about that, and we're going to try to get one of the pastors of one of the churches that I've spoken at each time I've been down there to join us via Skype when I get back, and we'll talk a little bit about that. So excited about that, but just incredible months ahead as far as, like I said, just going, gone more than I'm here, I think, for a period of time. And for 2 months, that'll be overseas more than I'm in the United States. It's going to be insane. Anyway, I obviously was gone when I was leaving. I was heading out the door on Friday morning. I went up to Flagstaff for the Building Tomorrow's Church Conference when the Supreme Court of the United States, when we talk about rendering decisions, I have a hard time anymore looking at Supreme Court decisions as decisions, because in the country I grew up in, those words had meaning. That is, though already there were fundamental cracks in the foundation, I realize that, but the idea was that you had a source and were drawing your decisions from this source. At least that's what we were still taught to believe. Maybe I was naive in my younger years, and we're just now seeing it much more obviously. I don't know. But anymore, words don't have meanings. And rights are derived from autokraterism. That's a new term. I just made it up. Pantokrator is the creator of all things. So autokraterism. We now live in a society of self-created beings. We are all autonomous now. And autonomy is now the central dogmatic assertion of the religion of secularism. And that's what allows Bruce Jenner to decide that he's a woman. That's what allows 8-year-olds to decide that they're not the gender that they are, and hence we can fill them with drugs and things like that because they are their own creator. Talk a little bit more about that later on. But anyway, so I haven't had a chance really to comment. I did a brief video while I was up in Flagstaff. And, by the way, did have a wonderful time at the conference, was run really well, and it was encouraging to meet young Reformed Baptists from around the United States, and one from Canada, and I think one from Mexico. So they got an earful from me because I spoke just hours after all of this happened, and so it was pretty quiet, especially during my first presentation. I think they've been posted. I think I saw on Twitter. I think I saw on Twitter that they had been put up. So if we need to track them down, I need to put them on the blog and stuff like that, so others can see them as well. But it was pretty quiet in there because I reminded them that on September 11th, 2001, said that was the first day of class at Grace Christian School. That was the year I was teaching Bible at Grace Christian School. And I said to those teenagers when they came in that day, I said, your life changed today. You don't know that yet, but your life fundamentally changed today. And I think about one fellow in that class, Tony Brewer, who just drove me insane during that entire class. He was just... the most unhinged I ever became in that class was at Tony Brewer one day. I still remember it, and so does he, and so does my son. Tony is he's on the bomb squad. He's served tours in Iraq and Afghanistan doing the bomb thing. So I was pretty right that his life had changed that day in ways he could not possibly foresee in that sense. And basically what I said to the kids was, today's another one of those days where I can look at you and say, your life changed today. Your life changed fundamentally today. And it's going to be their generation that is going to bear the brunt. I mean, I've lived, you know, even if I lived to 100, I've still lived half my life already. And you know, they've still got everything in front of them. And their choices were deeply impacted by what took place in the Supreme Court, where, as the dissenting justices, a couple of them put it, five black-robed lawyers overthrew just the most fundamental concepts of civilization and everything else, all in the name of liberty, which they don't really understand what that word is all about. But anyway, so had a really good time up there, and then went straight up to Salt Lake City and had another good time with the folks at Christ Presbyterian Church, the OPC Church in Magna, Utah, which is sort of western side of Salt Lake City. And had a great time there. First got there, they were trying to act like Phoenix. You know, 106 and this kind of silliness. But I will just mention in passing, I'm probably back up there again in the future. Because it's been a long time. Tough drive. It was easier coming back through Page than, I don't know why I hadn't remembered that, but it was a long time ago. But they have something that I really like up there. And it's not the temple. It is taco time, I will admit. I was sending pictures of crisp meat burritos to Warren, because he likes them too, so there is the crisp meat burritos at Taco Time temptation, which is good. But I discovered the climbs out of Salt Lake City, and they're not far away. I mean, it was like a 20-25 minute drive from my hotel to where I could stop, park, and start riding. And at first I went up Little Cottonwood Canyon up to the Alta ski area up there. And I've heard about all these places. I'm not a skier. I like my knees where they are. And so I don't ski. But I've heard of all these places before. And man, that was a killer climb. That was something. The first 2 days did that. Then I went to a bike store and the guy said, yeah, I really tried Big Cottonwood. It's a much nicer street. Well, wow, was he right. Freshly paved, a nice big bike path, and it went all the way up to what's called Guardsman Pass. Oh, man. I posted the pictures on Facebook. I had heard of Guardsman. It's part of the Tour of Utah, and it's infamous. 12% grade with straight drop off to your right, and you're on the right side of the road. So it's woohoo, and coming down it. I want disc brakes. I'm getting a bike with disc brakes for doing that kind of stuff in the future. Because wow, but just fantastic, fantastic riding up there. So, by the way, just in passing, I will be speaking in Denver on this coming Sunday, assuming that I don't end up falling off one of those mountains on Saturday. Because I will be riding in what's called the Triple Bypass ride on Saturday. So, supposed to be up there on Sunday at L2 is the website for the church, I think. And I'll be speaking on Islam while I'm up there. And so if you're in the Denver area, then, you know, feel free. Nah, you know what's wrong with that? It blocks the screen.
What does?
As long as you put it back, it's not going to. But right now, it's blocking the screen. So anyway, good time up there, but it did keep me from having the opportunity of interacting much. Now, we are going to be doing something this afternoon with Jeff Durbin and Apollo Gia. Unfortunately, it's not going to be quite what we wanted to do. We were providentially hindered at one point today. And so, you know, we're just going to have to trust the Lord to put the people together that, you know, just make it work. But we're going to be addressing this as well with Jeff and some others. And so it is important to address this. Have you noticed how things have changed in 1 week? Just a little over a week? I sure have. Have you noticed? Let me give you an example. Matthew Vines. Matthew Vines is a 25-year-old college dropout. And yet, he just excused his refusal to defend his position in debate. For me, it's because all I can do is compare homosexuality to bestiality, incest, and pedophilia. That's all I've ever done, folks. You listen to my response, my 5-hour response to Matthew Vines, my 5-hour response to David Gushy. That's all I ever did. I never discussed anything else. Right? Right. And then, in the same comment thread on his Facebook page, he dismisses Michael Brown as not being a meaningful scholar, because I don't see him being cited. He's a 25-year-old college dropout. He can't read the original languages. And he's saying, Michael Brown, he's not really a scholar. Really? Fascinating. I think they recognize that on the one hand, they want to project the idea that we are training people to go into churches and from our perspective, subvert the very faith of the saints. That's what the revisionist project is about. Is attacking the very foundations of the Christian faith from within churches. But the idea is we will train you to do argumentation within churches. I said in the 40 answers thing. He posts those 40 questions, and someone on Twitter sent it to me. I thought, you know what? Let's be brief, but let's answer these. And I did. And I said, I'll come to your conference, place of your choice, and I'll debate you and Brownson and Gushy all at the same time if you want. Or in series. Everybody knows that's not going to happen. And it has even less chance of happening now. Because from their perspective, they have all the momentum. And it would be foolish to give voice. Because now what they recognize is, we've got the media in our pocket. We have the millennials in our pocket. They will not critically examine what we're saying. They will not look at what we're really trying to do in a meaningful fashion. So let's just shut down any and all dialogue with anybody who can meaningfully challenge us. That's the attitude since June 26th. I'm so glad it was June 26th and not June 25th. If your anniversary is June 26th, I'm sorry, but mine's June 25th. And so I'm glad it wasn't on the 33rd anniversary of my having actually married my wife, which is why she's my wife and I'm her husband, because the word marry had meaning then. And it still does. It's just that, the people I feel the most for are the young people, are the millennials that have had stolen from them meaningful definitions of words like freedom and liberty and marriage and character and integrity. They're the ones that are fueling all of this, but don't seem to realize that in the process, the whole reason for this is they're trading away their humanity for something much less. Something much less. Anyway, much has been said. I listened to or read, depending on how you want to put it. I mean, but I listened to the entirety of the SCOTUS decision and the dissents. So the majority opinion, which, when you think about it, I mean, again, I just go back and look at what Elena Kagan was like before Barack Obama put her on the Supreme Court, and I just go, that's the whole reason she's there. She can retire now. She's done. That was what she was there to do. These five attorneys in robes, when you read what they said, what struck me again, aside from the shallow, if two men have adopted a child, then we can't let that child think that their family is lesser than anyone else's family. And you sit here and you facepalm because you go, so if we have, I mean, why not just go ahead and go all the way and say polygamy is good? Because it's done. I mean, the reasoning, and the dissent said this, but the reasoning is, it's right there. It's all done with. If that's the kind of emotional thing that causes the majority to do what they do and to find in the 14th Amendment rights that no one at the time of the 14th Amendment could have ever even dreamed of, it's done with. It's over with. But the main thing is that in listening to all of it, even listening to the dissents, there is no, from a Christian worldview, there was no meaningful discussion of the real issues. Because you see, all the way back to Lawrence v. Texas, you can no longer talk about morality or immorality. Well, you can in a passing sense. It is moral to create rights so that people are quote-unquote equal. That's the great morality. Even if you have to destroy everything that's good, honest, and just in the process. But you can't talk about any sexual behavior as being immoral. So, I mentioned this when the DOMA case took place. If you listen to the argumentation, there was not a single word about morality or immorality. And if we can address these issues in our society without being able to say anything about morality or immorality, it's over with. It's done. How can you even talk about things like murder? Why are we putting murderers in jail? What's the moral foundation for saying that that's wrong? And as soon as you ask that question, the issues of ultimate authorities come into view, and you can't talk about that anymore. You just, it has to be assumed as a given. So it struck me that though there were some real good zinger lines in the defense, still, the whole discussion was from a Christian worldview irrelevant. The whole thing. Yeah, sure, there were good observations that, you know, no nation before 2001 had ever done anything like this, and this is all these other decisions the majority referred to all had to do with heterosexual relationships and blah, 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 blah. Sure, there were good observations, but if you can't talk about morality and immorality in a court of law, waste of breath and waste of paper and waste of disk space. It's all just so much noise. It's all just so much noise. So it didn't shock me, but it certainly made me realize once again the vast chasm that exists between the Christian worldview and its ability to give a foundation and the secular worldview, which cannot give you any foundation at all. Now, I spoke, and I maybe Rich should have time to find out. I'd be interested to see if Christ Presbyterian posted the audio on their YouTube channel of my sermon from Sunday morning. Yeah, Sunday morning. Because I did at least one-third of the sermon was on Hebrews 13:4, which I did preach on in obviously the series through Hebrews, so it was a couple years ago. But there's just my mind has been doing a lot of thinking about all the ramifications and all the interconnectedness of worldview and the fact that this was just a big leap at the end of a lot of small steps that have been going on for a long, long time. It started off as a walk of rebellion. It became a trot of rebellion. It became an all-out run of rebellion. And this was the long jump at the end of it, you know? This was the, you know, and instead of dropping into a nice sandy pit, this was right off the edge of the cliff. And there are so many things that have led up to this, that looking back, you can see them. You can see the intention. You can see the direction. You know, lots of people have recognized, you know, World War II. World War II has led to this. That generation was so radically scarred by what took place over those, well, depending on which nation you're in, 4 to 8 years. There was so much death, so much destruction, and so many people that as a result were driven from having any meaningful Christian worldview that you just start seeing. You know, most people look at the 60s. Now, the 60s couldn't have happened without the 40s. The 60s was the first step, and then you see, like I said, start off, then jogging, then running, and then and that's where we are now. But there were so many things, so much that has had to come together. Somebody on Twitter was just asked, and a lot of people have mentioned this, if it had not been for the advent of medical capacity so as to provide for quote-unquote birth control, in the sense of removing from sexuality anything that has to do with recognizing the need for a commitment between a man and a woman because of the responsibility they bear in bringing forth life. This could never have happened. But remember, when was it? About 3 years ago, there was a... Who was it? I think it, for some reason, I think it had something to do with Campolo, I think. But I remember seeing a video about 3 years ago, and I remember mentioning it because I saw it in here, where you had these homosexuals, all these homosexuals there, and they're just talking honestly about the fact that the reason they love homosexual sex is because they don't have to worry about having kids. It's great. We don't have to worry about pregnancy. Because pregnancy is a horrible thing. Remember when Barack Obama said, you know, I try to teach my girls morals, but if they slip and fall, they shouldn't be punished with a child. Remember that? Children are a punishment. And then you see what happens when you have an entire culture where motherhood and fatherhood become disconnected from one another. Remember in Matthew 19, he will leave his father and his mother and cling to his wife. The idea is that father and mother are still together. There is something vitally important about a son seeing how his father relates to his mother and seeing how his mother relates to his father. And when that's broken, people miss it. And they know they miss it, and they feel that. They feel that brokenness. They feel that something's been taken from them. And we have an entire culture now in the United States amongst you have amongst blacks. In our culture, and this is something that black Christians talk about all the time. Well, meaningful black Christians, not cultural black Christians. There is a difference. You all know that. Cultural black Christianity, which is basically a political movement, not a religious movement, is completely different than the people who are actually serious about the Bible and the gospel and things like that. They're the ones, the Bodie Balcoms out there that they get to preach on this, and us pasty white guys, we say anything about it, we're automatically bad, evil, and everything else. But I saw a horrific article this morning about a 14-year-old being charged with murder for the rape and then burning of a 16-year-old girl. He's 14. He's 14. Yes, he's black. She was black. And the vast majority of children born in the black community do not have a father. And you see the horrific behavior of these young men. And we dismiss it because they're kids, and nobody grows up now until they're 30. You know, in Jesus' day, you became a man at 13. Now it's 30. But we hardly even talk about it. You know, you just mentioned, oh yeah, but you don't want to go to Chicago, don't want to be after dark, you know. It all goes back to the same stuff. It all goes back to the dehumanization and the resultant culture of death. It has to do with disconnecting husband and wife, the commitment that is theirs, the no-fault divorce stuff of the 70s. Up till then, we had this idea that there was actually a commitment there, that it was a binding commitment, that there had to be a reason for this, that all the rest of it, that's, you know, throw that out. Sexuality just becomes something that's centered upon my own self-gratification. It has nothing to do with commitment, long-term life commitment any longer. And the family structure falls apart. You don't have those examples anymore. And it's all part of dehumanization. These people, they've been dehumanized. They have no respect for human life, no concept of a creator. And that's why I said what we see going on is this absolute dogma of autonomy. I get to define who I am. I get to do what every man does what's right in his own eyes. That's where we are right now. That's what we're facing. And so it's all connected together. And we are seeing how it's connected together with far more clarity than we ever have before. Once it just all starts coming apart, you really are given a vantage point to be able to look back and say, "Oh, well, this is why it fell apart. This is why it fell apart." I preached on Hebrews 13:4, marriage to be held in honor among all, and the marriage bed is to be undefiled. For fornicators and adulterers, God will judge. There was a day when it was well known that in this country, judges realized that there was a higher authority than they themselves, and that they wanted to reflect that higher authority. And the last phrase here, kronai hatheos, God will judge. There is a basic, fundamental, foundational issue in the New Testament that God must judge. There must be judgment. There must be a day when justice is done. There must be a day when evil is punished and good is vindicated. We long for that. We long for that day. And the biblical teaching is that there is something called porneia. And it's called fornication. It's sexual sin. And I do not believe that anyone from James Brownson on down could ever argue that homosexuality would not be included by the author of the book of the Hebrews under porneia. The only way they can get around it, this is what Brownson does, this is what all the liberals do, is to say, well, they just didn't know about the narrow little category of homosexual behavior that we're trying to defend. Now, we won't actually criticize and we won't actually speak out against the majority of homosexual behavior and how it manifests itself. We won't speak out against the gay pride parades where they've got 5-year-olds twerking and think it's wonderful. We won't speak out against all that stuff because that's our base. We have to be very loving. But we'll only defend, and we'll make it sound like what we're talking about is just this narrow spectrum that nobody in the Bible knew about. Nobody in the Bible knew about. People who just want to have a monogamous, lifelong, committed relationship. That's the mantra. That's the mantra. So they have to basically say, well, yeah, for this author, when it says the marriage bed is undefiled, they never would have thought of anything other than heterosexual marriage. But that was their ignorance. And so you have to begin with a lower view of Scripture. Not that men spoke from God as they're carried along by the Holy Spirit, but men spoke from their hearts, and then the Holy Spirit makes it special to us. Those are not synonymous phrases. They are not synonymous phrases. And the results are not the same. It's interesting, especially if you have listened to the many times that we have had to address the issue of arsenokoites in 1 Corinthians 6, 1 Timothy 1, and the revisionist efforts to redefine that term. Its meaning is clear. Its meaning is easily established. Its origin and source is found in specifically Leviticus 20:13, but also Leviticus 18:22 in the Greek Septuagint, and it refers to a male homosexual. And when coupled with malakos, malakoi, in 1 Corinthians 6, becomes the male partner, the aggressive partner in the male-male relationship. It strikes me interesting that the term that is used in the Greek of Hebrews 13:4 is he koite amiantos. Amiantos. Put the emphasis on the wrong syllable. So it's koite, as in arsena koite. And arsena koite means what men do with men in bed. It's sexual activity in the bed. And so here, the koite is directly related to hagamos, which is marriage. So the marriage bed, that's why the translations render it the way it is. The marriage bed, defined by gamos, which in that context can only be heterosexual, is undefiled. What does that mean about the Episcopalian Church, which very quickly capitulated totally and is now doing pseudo-marriages, profaning the name of Christ in the process and profaning marriage in the process? What does that mean for people who pretend that they can be a husband and a husband and a wife and a wife? What about that gamos? Well, it is not amiantos. It is defiled. It's defiled. And the very next word is pornus. Pornia. Fornication. When you defile the marriage bed, the result is fornication or adultery. Both are there. And so, the only way that a faithful, believing Christian who believes that these words have been preserved by God, because they were breathed out by God, and that they are the normative authority for what we are to believe. The only way a Christian who believes that can look at what took place in the United States on June 26th is that the Supreme Court of the United States has said, you can defile the marriage bed, and it is good. It is good. Pornia is good. And Hebrews says, God will judge pornus kai moikus. God will judge fornicators and adulterers. Now, you can say, no, I don't think he will. I don't think he will. I don't think God's going to judge anyone. You can say that if you want. But just be honest and say, I reject what is written in the New Testament. I abhor it and I reject it. And that's your right. And you will be, you know, you only have a certain number of years on the earth. And if you want to stand before God someday and say, yes, I heard your word and I rejected it, and you know, that's up to you. That's up to you. My job, if I care for you, is to warn you what you are going to be facing when you do that. And in fact, if I don't warn you, in fact, the people that show you the greatest disrespect are the people who, knowing that's there, will not tell you, will not warn you. At least when you look back, if what this is said and you stand before God someday to be judged for the deeds you did in the body, you're not going to be able to say, he didn't tell me. In fact, he told me it would be a good thing to hold these beliefs and engage in these activities. And so you're not going to be able to say that to me and to any other faithful Christian that stands firm on these issues. God will judge, and he will judge righteously. He will judge perfectly, but his standard is his own perfection. His standard is the very perfection that caused Isaiah, one of the most holy men in Israel, upon seeing him to say, woe is me, I'm undone, I'm a man of unclean lips, and I live amongst people of unclean lips. As soon as you see the holiness of God, every single pretense of self-righteousness will vanish instantly, evaporate, absolutely evaporate. So, what do we do now? Well, I know of at least two books coming out. I didn't get a chance to, I hope to get a chance to read the second one pretty soon. But there are two books coming out by two men, one of whom I know very well, one of whom I have not had the opportunity of meeting but respect greatly. Which will probably both be out within a matter of weeks. I've already told you about Michael Brown's book. Albert Mohler has a book coming out as well. And I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I will be reading it. Thank you very much for that opportunity of doing so. But there will be others. Those two are going to be helpful. Many of the others are going to come out will be triumphalistic and will be a part of the tsunami that I've been telling you about for a long time of utter compromise and collapse. It's time to move on. This isn't a hill to die on. If we want to be relevant, this is where our society is, then we need to move on, which means that's a part of God's truth that we won't talk about anymore. That's a part of God's truth that we will be embarrassed about. That is a part of God's truth that we will say, we'll come up with a way around it. We'll come up with a way around it. And there's all sorts of books already out there that will allow people to do that. And the pressure, it's one thing right now. I'm talking to people right now. There are people watching this broadcast right now. I saw Armin over in the cool climes of a certain Scandinavian country, posted a picture of the feed on a big honking big screen there, which is sort of scary. But especially since you've switched this close view, you can go back and forth. You know, the other view, you know, has the lava lamp and stuff, and so you don't want to just stay with there. You got it's much better. Right? There will be flowers in this shot within a couple weeks. I fell in love with a flower. You saw the flowers. Those things are gorgeous. I found a source of dried ones.
I don't think that can survive down here, can it?
No, these are dried.
Oh, okay.
I found some dry. I found a place where I could buy some dried ones.
Okay, so you're going to bring old dead flowers in. Okay,
yep.
I got it.
Yep. Okay. Yep. But I ran those are the most beautiful things I had seen, and here I am climbing Guardsman Pass, and I stopped and got off my bike, got my phone out, and because they're just gorgeous, just gorgeous. But anyways, so thank you for getting off of the tight shot, which is makes me nervous. Anyway, what was I talking about? There are people watching this webcast right now. They're sitting there going, "All right, yeah, yeah." 5 years from now, you will not be watching this, if it's even still on. 5 years from now, you'll probably be supportive of the suppression of our right to say the things I'm saying right now. And it won't be because of any radical thing in your life. It will be because of the regular, everyday pressure of standing firm on these issues. That's the far more effective way of changing how Christians view things. Is, well, you guys are becoming irrelevant. We can never become irrelevant, my friend. Christ died for his church. That's the most relevant thing in the world. What's irrelevant is every state and nation that passes away because it doesn't bow the knee to Christ. I mean, if you can buy that kind of stuff, you don't have a Christian worldview. You don't think biblically. You're not even on the same page. Anyway, that sermon was for free. There will be many who will not be standing and applauding any discussion of this subject. But it's just going to take some time. Right now, woohoo! You know, I'll never give in. But when it's the daily grind, it's the I can't get a job, I can't advance in my job, etc., etc., when that becomes the regular experience, you'll see changes.
I was going to say, you know, you want to talk about becoming irrelevant. I'm sure that they may have said things like that to Nero. I'm sure they, you know, Rome fell. You can go through history, and yet the Christian church, the Lord, has seen fit to shine the light in the darkness. And if what's relevant is the darkness, we're not going to become irrelevant because we're going to continue to illumine the darkness.
Yeah, relevancy is determined by ultimate authorities. And if your ultimate authority, well, for a lot of people it is, the number of people you have coming to your church and so on and so forth. If you don't see that the church very often is a small minority, it's the light in the midst of the darkness, but it's the apple of God's eye, it is the very object of Christ's redemptive love, he dies to redeem his people, his bride. If you don't see that that's what's important in God's perspective, then you pretty much have a secular worldview that you've blathered some religiosity on. We more than ever need to be exposing ourselves purposefully and knowingly to the Word of God, seeking to have it to conform our ways of thought to His way of thought more than ever before. Because it was one thing for us to exhort people to do that in the past, to be a good disciple of Jesus Christ. Now, it will give us the very reason to be willing to sacrifice and pay the cost of discipleship. You know, taking up your cross as an American had one meaning 50 years ago. It's going to have a completely different meaning in the future, much closer to the actual meaning, exegetically speaking. I'd like to hear what you have to say. I mean, did we have some callers? Were they weren't calling for the dividing line? Oh, okay. You told them to go away. I said we were going to open the phone lines. 877-753-3341, just right here at the end of the program, if you'd like to sound off. 877-753-3341. What's this? What happened? Did the Supreme Court shut down the DL? I don't know what that's about. Everything's looking good on your end? Oh, okay, good. 877-753-3341. Like I said, we will be doing something this afternoon, talking about this in more depth. Won't be able to do quite as much as we were hoping to do. There was some travel issues, unfortunately. But still a great opportunity to hopefully do something that will be encouraging to folks. And pray for us for clarity of thought, because I'll be perfectly honest with you, I've been thinking so much about this that there's sort of an overload of thoughts, too many things that have crossed my mind that sort of end up as a jumble when you want to try to throw it all out there. And so prayers for that would be appreciative, would be appreciated, because I think a lot of folks are experiencing that. Let's go to the phone lines and let's talk with Elizabeth. Hi, Elizabeth. Hello, Elizabeth.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm doing well. I just want to, I'm a seventh grade math teacher, and my husband is a pastor and a bus driver, and some of the things we have to deal with is that my husband has third graders that are telling him that one little boy said that his grandmother told him that he's really a girl in a boy's body, and I deal with seventh graders that are confused that way,
yeah.
And I so thank Dr. White for what he says that give us the words and the love and the care for these children that are just being fed lies from
it
those
is,
that are supposed to take care of them.
Yeah, it is amazing. I have thought a number of times, I don't know how those of you who work in the education system, I don't know how you're going to be allowed to continue to do that. There is such a strong emphasis on towing the line and having a consistent message. And the now, obviously, math is math. Well, I'll take that back. After Common Core, I'm not sure about that, but. You know, at least you're not teaching social studies or something like that where, you know, it's blatant. But still, that whole area, man, that is really, really difficult to deal with that. And unless you're clear in your worldview and clear in your commitments, there's going to be some real difficulties for you. So
exactly. I see it as being in Caesar's house, and I think of Paul and how he took a stand with those who were in Caesar's house, the guards and so forth. And we have a responsibility to shine the light. And one of the things I love about mathematics is I tell people 2 plus 2 is equal to 4. Except if you're in non-Euclidean geometry, that's really out there, and that's not a biblical worldview mathematics. But 2 plus 2 equals 4, there are absolutes.
Yeah.
Don't tell me there aren't.
Yeah. Yeah, I'll admit, math, I was always a straight A student, so I always got A's in math. But I got 99s in English and history, and I got 89.8s in math and got rounded up. But the one thing, the one time I really enjoyed math was in my sophomore year in high school when we did trigonometry and we did logical proofs.
Yeah.
And oh man, that was the one time my grades were in the high 90s and hundreds at that time, because that was great. But other areas, not so much. Like when I got into chemistry and stuff, that's when mathematics started being my enemy again, not my friend. But anyway, you didn't need to know about that. But press on, be faithful. Thank you, Elizabeth.
Thank you so much.
All
God,
right,
God bless you and your program, and you're all in our prayers.
Thank you very much. God bless. Bye-bye.
Okay. Yep.
All right. Let's talk to Thomas. Hi, Thomas.
Hey, Dr. White. How you doing?
Doing good.
That's good. Hey, I'm sorry to change the subject. I've been trying to get in touch for a little bit. It seems like my work schedule, anytime that you're taking calls, I'm busy working, so it's one of the rare times. But I hate to kind of change the subject, but I had a question about Calvinism and creaturely will, if that's all right.
Okay.
Is it fair to kind of use an analogy as far as our creaturely will? Because I know you're a Star Trek fan. Is it fair to compare our creaturely will like a character's free will that's a holodeck character from Star Trek?
Well, no.
Okay.
As much as I like Star Trek, you must realize that Star Trek is a thoroughly secular comes from a – well – the modern Star Trek came from a thoroughly secular worldview. There was that one absolute canonical violation of the secularism of Star Trek in the original series. I don't know if you remember right at the end of the thing, that it was when they went to this planet and the Romans were on this planet, basically, type thing, they right at the end they talked about, no, they're not worshiping the sun. They're talking about the Son of God. Remember, Uhura said that, you know. And it was just it was so out of character that obviously Roddenberry had been on vacation that week or something, and that's the only way it ever snuck in there. But anyway, now I would, just as in the Doctrine of the Trinity, I recommend that people avoid analogies that end up teaching heresy, which any really analogy of the Trinity will, because the Trinity is unique and therefore all analogies will fail. There are plenty of analogies in Scripture that provide us with what we need, and I think when we try to go beyond them to something else, that becomes dangerous and even damaging to our position. So I think that, you know what I ought to do sometime is grab the predestination box off of the shelf in there. You know, it's still up. It's still in there. No. I'm not talking about the box of the light. Don't you remember the wooden box? Yes, it's up on the top shelf in the other room.
I wonder how that would look over video.
We should test that. I think it could work.
Yeah.
I think it could work.
By the way, there was another Star Trek episode where they talked about, they had a guy in some station quoting Psalms right and left. Don't you remember that one?
Wait a minute. Are you talking about the original Star Trek?
Yes.
Quoting Psalms?
Yes, he was quoting Psalms. He kept talking about the scriptures right and left. And he was driving the guy. It was like a missile silo. Remember when they went back to the nuclear age? And this two guys in the silo with the keys? And the one guy kept quoting Psalms and talking about God this and God that. And the other guy with him, he was driving him crazy. But you do not remember this.
No.
I out-trekkied you. Ha!
I'm starting to think that that may not have been a Star Trek episode either. It might have been a movie you're confusing.
No, that was Star Trek. That was in the episode where they went back in time.
Which time when they went back in time? They went back in time.
Yeah, I was just saying. I mean, are you talking to, you know?
I don't have the exact episode number.
I'm feeling challenged because the only one where they went back there was when they got that captain and beamed him out of his old jet before it blew up, and then they had to do the slingshot.
There was one more time.
Yeah, but I don't remember anything about any missile silos in that one. So,
well, no, there was one where they go back in time and they pick up that dude that was a human, but aliens had him because it was supposed to be a pilot for a new show that never got off the ground. You know, and he does some work on a missile, on a rocket that's going up.
That's the one. And here we go. We're going to have to go along on the show because we're talking about Star Trek.
Oh, we've got people online. We're going to go along. I'm going to have to look that up because I've seen all of them many, many times, and it's just not ringing a bell. So maybe it's just how you're describing it. But anyways, Thomas, I'm sorry. That's why I would avoid that. There are so many biblical analogies that, you know, the problem with a hologram-type situation is that that's artificial. And what I'm really concerned about, what bothers me there, is that one of the things I emphasize is that the incarnation, from a Christian perspective, demonstrates the reality and importance of events in time and man's will in time. I think that's one of the reasons why you see the struggle in Jesus, for example, in the Garden of Gethsemane. I mean, that's not a robotic or secondary type thing. There's a real struggle there. He has a real will. It's not death that he fears. It's becoming sin, obviously, that is the issue. But still, that incarnation demonstrates that time and the experiences in time are not just simply a holodeck or a puppet stage, that this is actually what God has chosen to do to demonstrate his own attributes and demonstrate his own glory. So it's real in a sense that none of those analogies actually, I think, can address. So I guess that's why I stick with a biblical analogy there.
I hear you. Okay, that makes sense. I guess I'm still struggling then, I guess, with our will versus the hidden will of God and how all of that is working out. I'm still digesting that.
Well,
in
keep,
my mind.
Keep struggling, keep working on it, but the best place to do that is in the context of Scripture itself.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Thomas. All right. God bless. All right. And let's talk with Mark in Minnesota. Hi, Mark.
Hey. And Dr. White, it's good to talk to you.
Yes, sir.
I got a degree in history from a secular college in Illinois back when I lived there. And then about 20 years ago, I can't remember the name of the book, but we had to read this book on the sexual mores of American troops and how they were negatively impacted, from a Christian worldview anyways, by the time in Europe especially. And there was talk of massive prostitution going on in England before the Normandy invasion. And, yeah, it's just really eye-opening because I've never heard of anything like that happening here, but even the public parks became places where prostitution was just happening all over the place. And so what they said, my take as a believer, was that our guys went over there, they know that they're facing death, and for nominal Christians, they said, well, I might as well have a little fun and experience, you know, sexual intimacy before I die.
Right.
And so it broke down their social mores that they had come from, the Christian basis of our nation. And then what it does when they come home is they know they've got this secret that they can never tell anybody because we're a society and a church society, especially of shame back then, where you can't confess and say, you know, I screwed up. You have to keep it a secret, and so then it totally hamstrings them from preparing the next generation to give a godly answer to the pressures of morality and the 1960s happen as a result of that vacuum.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that has to be combined, though, with the dehumanizing violence.
Sure.
You know, I know more about that in the pressure cooker of Tarawa or Okinawa or, you know, that kind of thing. You know, it all goes together. But, yeah, I was not aware of that. I was not aware of that.
Yeah, I wasn't either. And it just, yeah, like you say, exactly. It's just one more thing, one more breakdown of their worldview, of their sense of morality and of who they are as Americans and, you know, cultural Christians at the time. So,
yeah. Well, I appreciate that insight, Mark.
You're very welcome.
All right, God bless. Thank you.
Thank you, you too.
All right, bye-bye. There is a Twitter thing. We'll get both Carlos and Josh in here. We can go a few minutes late. No, the network is not going to get on us at all, you know, because there is no network. But 1689 Black RBAP, Reformed Baptist, did remind me of something here on Twitter. Captain Kirk, mankind has no need for gods. We find the one quite adequate. I remember that quote. I do remember that quote. Was that the one with, No, that's Kirk. Kirk was in Undiscovered Country, but that was a movie. This is in the series, and I think it was with Apollo. Remember when Apollo, wanted them to worship him and all the rest of that stuff. And I think that was that one with Apollo. I'm not sure. But, yes, it's Star Trek Day on Alpha Omega Ministries, Dividing Line, whatever. Yeah. All right, let's talk with Carlos. Hi, Carlos.
Hey, Dr. White. So apart from the usual pleasantries everyone goes through, direct straight to the meat here, I was thinking about the hedonistic paradox. Are you familiar with that?
In Titus?
No, the hedonism paradox is something I was reading in a secular journal, and let me switch you off. Let me switch you off my Bluetooth there. The hedonistic paradox is basically the more pleasure you seek, the more discontent you are with the pleasure you have, so you continuously seek additional pleasures. Are you familiar with that paradox at all?
No, but it makes sense. I mean, if your focus, I mean, it's sort of a basic Christian teaching that if your focus is upon satisfying your physical lusts, you can never get enough. You will become a slave of that which you seek to experience. So maybe that just sounds like sort of a philosophical way of saying the same thing.
That probably is. I mean, everything pretty much goes back to the premises and principles of God, but it seems to me like when you do actual research and what the world has to say about it, it matches a lot with what we're seeing with the current LGBTQA, whatever you want to call it, movement. Because with the hedonistic paradox, the the more a person gets into it, the more violently, in some cases, they'll lash out and react against others who do anything that, of course, kills their buzz.
Right, right. Well, yeah, there is. I think there's a lot of reasons for the dedication of homosexuals to their movement. That would be part of it, but I think even more than that is the suppression of the knowledge of God and the fact that they want people, that they demand that people celebrate them and their sexuality. The reasons for that, I think, are only understandable within a Christian worldview. I don't think a secularist, you know, they might be able to come up with the hedonistic paradox or something like that, but I don't think that really answers the whole range of reasons why we are observing this and seeing this. So, but we certainly do see it, and it certainly has been an effective tool given the fear that is evident not only in governmental leaders, but the fear that's evident in corporate and business leaders. I am sick and tired of having homosexuality shoved down my throat by my bank and by my.
You're missing an arena there too, though.
What's that?
Something. It's in the family system as well. Something that well, not to get too into the weeds, but I've actually had issues with a couple of my kids turning to homosexuality and being told that, hey, you know, you can't parent them this way anymore because it's detriment to them. So, you know, people like myself end up in an awkward situation because of the changing climate and whatnot.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's and the speed with which it has happened has been absolutely mind-numbing. I think we're definitely on the catch-up side, unfortunately, because of that. So, anyway, Carlos, thank you very much for your phone call.
Thanks.
All right, God bless. One more here. We went a little bit long. Let's talk with Josh. Hi, Josh.
Hey, Dr. White. I had a question on 1 Corinthians 6.
Uh-huh.
I enjoy reading ESV, NASB, and I'll even compare Holman sometimes. And I noticed the NASB, when it's translating the nominatives in 1 Corinthians 6 in the list, it kind of keeps it as identity, like a person who is an idolater or a person who is a thief. But then I noticed in the ESV and Holman, it changed homosexuals and effeminate to one word, and it changed it to a practice rather than keeping it with like an identity that they are homosexuals. Rather than saying they are homosexual and are effeminate, it changed it to they practice homosexuality. And I was wondering if you could explain that, why they would switch there, or, I mean, again, I like ESV. I'm not attacking it or anything.
Well, yeah, I've mentioned a number of times that I think the ESV has done a very good job there, because the phrase is uta malakoi uta arsenokoitai, and malakoi means soft or effeminate. Arsenokoitai is comes from Leviticus 20:13, and it is plainly male homosexuals. And what the ESV is interpreting this is, Why would malakoi be where it is between adulterers and homosexuals? And they're taking it as a combined phrase that refers to the active and passive partners in male homosexual contact. And
yeah.
So the arsenokoitai would be the aggressive dominant, and the malakoi would be the effeminate feminine in that relationship. And I think there's good reason for seeing it that way. And whenever I address 1 Corinthians 6:9 in my teaching, I make sure people understand there are two terms here, and that's why in most translations you see two terms being translated. But they are probably the ones that there's actually a descriptive here that is more descriptive than we might be comfortable with, actually.
Right.
So that's why they took it the way that they did, and I think there's a good foundation for that. As to translating it practice or statement, I don't think that's really, you know, again, I obviously am one that doesn't look at English translations as the final word, and so I'm looking at it, and it's understood that arsenokoites is one who practices a certain thing and is marked by that certain thing. So whether you render it as men who practice homosexuality or as homosexuals, I don't see that that's a...
Not a big difference.
A big difference, no.
Yeah. Okay. No. Well, thank you. I've just been studying. I'm a youth pastor here in Kansas and been reading Robert Gagnon's book and your stuff and Kevin DeYoung, and that's just been something I've been wondering about. So.
Okay. Well, good.
Thank you.
There you go.
All right.
Thanks, Josh. All right. God bless. Bye-bye. Good phone calls today. Thank you very much for participating in the program. And we went a little bit long there, but that's good. I think we'll be back a week from now. Yeah, should be. Got a long trip on Monday, but should be back a week from now. And if I recall correctly, that 1 week, that's the 1 week where we should be doing programs the whole week, I think. We'll see. But anyways, do pray for the recording this afternoon. And don't forget South Africa coming up and the neat opportunities coming up there. We'll see you next time on the Dividing Line. God bless.